CliffCentral.com.
Good morning, CliffCentral.com. On a Friday, we've got Bulelo is in, is it the Western Cape or the Eastern Cape? I can never figure out where that area is. Is it somewhere in the
middle? Yeah, it's on the border, Western Cape. It's on the Western Cape side of the Garden Route. And it kind of just starts that whole stretch, yeah.
All right. So as soon as you cross into the Eastern Cape, does everything suddenly become really shit?
Yes, I mean I'm from there, and I spoke of objectivity. Yes, the answer is yes.
Okay.
Once you hit sort of after you go past St. Francis, which is luckily you don't go past St. Francis, so Jeffreys Bay.
Yes.
Terrible. From there onwards, it's just a cosa gemors.
Well, that's very exciting.
I love my people, but
people of the Eastern Cape. It's great, lovely. Stand up for yourselves. You don't have to tolerate this from Bulelo. All right, a couple of things. We've got our sleep expert joining us in a short while. I'll tell you about her just now. But I got an email called Life in the Netherlands for Spoiled South Africans. It's from Amelia. Listen to this quickly. So she says, "Hey, Gareth, I'm enjoying the stories from your listeners regarding their life abroad. I thought I'd share mine with you and potentially help other South Africans to evaluate the decision of whether to move or to stay in SA. My husband and I moved to the Netherlands in November 2020 in the middle of a pandemic. My husband was presented with a work opportunity in Amsterdam and a full relocation package, including tax breaks and a five-year EU residence permit. The opportunity has been wonderful and extreme learning curves for us both." You remember Amelia was on, she was on Collectomania. She collects those rosaries, remember?
Yeah.
So she says, "What I've learned is that life as a middle-class suburban South African is, in my opinion, incomparable with the quality of life almost anywhere else in the world." And remember, she's moved around quite a lot, so she's been in the US. And, she says, "Regardless of the criteria used to evaluate your reason for relocation, leaving South Africa should not be an emotional decision, especially if it's based on a crime incident or trauma. Leaving family and loved ones is very traumatic and should not be underestimated. I wanted to summarize some of the few other sacrifices we've had to make to locate to another country. We don't have a domestic worker. Cleaning is not for the faint-hearted. It is also time-consuming and needs to be built into your daily schedule. You know, that's something that we take for granted in this country because labor is cheap and also because people need work. And it's a way of creating employment for some people. And cleaning, as much as it sounds demeaning, and it isn't, because we actually spoke to Sne on the show just the other day. Bulelo, you were on the show with me when we spoke to Sne, who lives in Ohio. And she's cleaning. She's actually a domestic worker. She's running three jobs, I think, at once, despite getting married to a dude in America. That's her job. And she says, you know, someone who's qualified, she's a graduate. That's what she does. She takes, she takes no nonsense from anybody when they come to judge her about her job, and neither should anyone in this country. But I digress, because as far as Amelia's concerned, we need to know that that's a major factor, not having a domestic worker. And in South Africa, most people can have a domestic worker. I know domestic workers who have domestic workers.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
And as the meme says, I fired myself from cleaning my house because I didn't like my attitude, and I got caught drinking on the job.
Beautiful. We also have a smaller home, she says. We left our beautiful South African home to move to a 90-square-meter apartment. This has taken a large amount of adjustment, and it's a little depressing at times. Healthcare is another big one. Everyone gets the same healthcare, which is great until you actually need your doctor and you find yourself waiting in a system for an appointment. The private healthcare system in South Africa is, again, in my opinion, second to none in the world, especially when compared with the NHI-styled schemes like the Netherlands. Some of the benefits of relocation have been access. She says, we have awesome access to travel around the globe and it's relatively cheap. But she goes on with the list, and I just thought it was important to mention those things because we are interested in the answers to these questions, because many people are, you know, we're global citizens now. And since travel has opened up again, you can go and live anywhere you want. Bulelo, you've been all over the place. I mean, there's a reason that you choose to be here. And there's a reason that some people choose to be there. So do what's right for you. I don't judge that anymore. And I certainly don't look down or look up when it comes to people who've decided to make a move. To me, it's just their decision. No big deal.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But
definitely. I think to that global citizen message.
Yeah, and I think what's so important about Amelia's email is that she says, don't make a decision based on an incident or a traumatic experience or an emotional reason. Emotional reasons for that kind of decision are a very bad idea. Mm. Let's all just remember that.
Emotional reasons for any decision are a bad idea, especially the more important a decision is, be less emotional.
Yeah,
like,
correct.
Like people think it's so spontaneous to be, you know what, I did it on a whim. No, that's a terrible thing. Then I don't want to hear you complain about outcomes.
Right.
The guy, his name eludes me, who we chatted to, who moved to New Zealand from South Africa 20 years ago.
Yeah.
What stuck with me there was, you don't realize when you're moving as a young adult that the adults that you leave behind are going to get older. And at some point, especially now during coronavirus, as he's found, you can't get back home to those who are aged and, you know, in ill health as easily.
That's a good point. Anyway, I just thought interesting email from Amelia, and thanks for sending that to us. And if you have a story that you'd like to share with us, either by email or if you'd like to join us on the show, like Caleb did with Dr. Hanan this week, we'd love to hear from you. Do that by sending me an email, contact@cliffcentral.com. We always reply to all the emails, so let us know what you're up to. Okay, we got in a couple of minutes' time, we're going to speak to Dr. Alison Bentley. Now, let me just quickly give you a précis of where she comes from, because she's no schmo when it comes to this stuff. She ran the first diagnostic sleep laboratory in South Africa from 1990 to 1998. She's also the founding chairperson of the, who knew, there's a Sleep Society of South Africa. And she...
Did they ever get anything done?
She founded it back in 1996 and served two terms representing Africa on the Governing Council of the World Association of Sleep Medicine. Her interest in research on sleep has seen her supervise more than 20 masters and 3 PhD students on various topics.
Wow.
And she, of course, is a doctor herself. So we'll speak to Dr. Alison Bentley in a short while from now. And
in the early 90s when she started all of this,
yeah.
I mean, even still, there are so many people who are unaware of sleep apnea and having to sleep with a ventilator or a CPAP machine. There's so many people who are still unaware of how there are many insomnia sufferers. And in the 90s, those studies would have been quite edgy. As mainstream as they are now.
I mean, Leanne, take some credit. You have popularized the sleeping Jesus. You can take some of the cred for that. I think you deserve it.
Yeah.
So we'll find out. We'll find out in a minute. There are a couple of things coming in here from people. I have a friend who moved to the UK, says Elon is God. He says he hates it. He hates the people. He says the people are shit and he has to clean his own house. I was shooketh. Okay. Carl is being his usual sarcastic self. I love this. I love the new theme of people sending emails of how shit it is in other countries. Makes me feel good for staying. Well, listen, to be fair, we also have received emails from people who are very happy that they've made a move.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's stupid to go, well, it's 50%, or it's 80-20 or whatever, because it doesn't matter. It's all about you, your own personal experience of it. And if your personal experience is a good one and you've made the move, then you're going to have a great reason to feel very comfortable and confident about your move. However, if you feel you've made the wrong move, you're going to be feeling shit about it. So that's up to you. It's got nothing to do with anything.
The only people that I will not tolerate or take anything off is like, once you go, like there was a time where I was like kind of bitter and it does, you know, it was obviously racialized a little bit in South Africa. Mm. And I kind of, but then as I've gotten older, the only people I won't take anything off is once you leave, you must leave. Like, enjoy your new country. I don't like the throw stones back over the pond, right?
Right.
Like, look how I was right and you guys are living in a, like, okay, fine. Enjoy the UK. Like, okay, we stayed. Those of us that stayed and choose to be here, are here, is enjoy the UK. Stop talking about how terrible South Africa is. Enjoy the UK. Now, we're open to feedback.
Yeah, sure.
Like, our listeners give where they go, yeah, where South Africa could get better is boom, boom, boom. But enough of the, I'm in the UK, what a shithole South Africa is anyway.
Well,
like, come on.
Isn't that just the same as someone who breaks up with somebody and then all they can do is talk about their ex, even though they keep pretending that they're happy about their new relationship, but they're still obsessed with their ex-girlfriend?
Yeah, no, well said.
No.
That's a great analogy. I think everyone can understand.
Lots of people like that. Leanne, you're on mute.
Yeah.
What's going on with you today?
New job. It's a different. It's a hard time. There was lightning earlier, Leanne. See, I'm more empathetic today.
Yeah, she's.
Thank you.
She's skittish.
But a lot going on. I've got a good story about cheating spouses and exes. So tell me when you're ready for that.
Let's go before we bring the sleep expert in. Go.
So this guy who had a girlfriend, the girlfriend went away for a while. And then came back with a new boyfriend and decided that this was her new boyfriend and moved in with him.
Hold on. Start again. I'm already confused. What? Who?
Okay. So there was a guy who had a girlfriend. Mm-hmm. The girlfriend went on a work trip.
Okay.
She then messaged him to say, pack your stuff and get lost. I'm coming back with a new boyfriend. I'm done.
All right.
Wow.
Okay. So obviously he was disappointed, but he decided to take revenge and he prepared a living hell for them in this house for just $100.
What did he do?
He bought 20 of these little gadgets online. They're called noisemakers.
Oh God.
They're little gadgets that emit these annoying sounds and he hid them all over the house. this grew into, you won't believe how this actually grew into something so big. So some of them, they emit sounds at just the right volume that you're not quite sure if you really heard it. So you might be sitting in the room with your new boyfriend. One might hear it. The other can barely hear it. They last for absolutely ages with a little battery in them. They fit into light fixtures and wall outlets. This guy hid them all over the house, in her car, even in a boat that her father got her. He says they were a rich family that grew up sailing. They say they make these noises at random intervals. So it could be minutes, could be hours, or it could take a whole day off. Some of the noises they make is like children laughing.
Oh my God.
Like a death rattle, like a dying breath.
God.
A whistle. Some of them are scratching noises.
Oh my God.
And completely unpredictable. So you can't figure them out. So he says, months go by, I get a new place, get my life back up. Now we had a few friends in common. One of them I kept up with.
Yeah.
They were kind of sour about how she ended things, but they'd grown up together and kept up the friendship anyway, loosely catching up and talking. He says, I never really asked about her, but one day we get to talking and he's wanting to prank some friends on a camping trip. So I tell him about the noisemakers. As I'm telling him about them, he slowly starts making this face like he's gradually losing his shit. He's got this huge grin on his face and says, did you put these in your ex's house? Because when he admits it, he starts laughing hysterically.
Oh my God.
Turns out that the new boyfriend only lasted a few months. He left saying he couldn't handle whatever it was going on with them and their mental states. for a while, they both heard the things together and then only one would hear them. So this gave them the illusion that something was really messed up and going on in their heads at different times. So eventually he left completely. And he said he believed that he'd been infected with some brain worm that the government was putting in vaccines or something like that.
Let me tell you, this will drive you crazy. If what you're describing, because I looked up noisemaker, they're tiny little things that essentially have one of those flat batteries in them. And in fact, if you go into Amazon, you can find them. So it comes in a little plastic bag, probably, you know, like one of those very, very tiny sandwich bags. But inside it's got a little battery, one of those CR2032 batteries, those flat ones, like a watch battery almost. And then it's got a little speaker. And you could basically hide this thing anywhere. It's got a super long battery life. and it won't stop making this noise. But with the noises you were describing, Leanne, I mean, if this was sewn into the bottom of a curtain, or it was hidden behind, you know, a picture on a wall, or in the, underneath the mattress of a bed, you could find pretty bizarre places to hide these things. People would think they were going crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, eventually she moved out. She told her parents she didn't want the house. Just give it to her, my brother, she said, or sell it, but didn't tell them why. So, you know,
I want to buy some.
He says that his current wife knows the story by heart, and it's her favorite one to tell.
God, that's amazing. I mean,
yeah, that is
so the sounds, I mean, if you've got like children laughing, that would be spooky as hell. Imagine you're falling asleep
like a
at night.
Death rattle.
And it doesn't come on. Apparently it comes on at random. That's what you were saying, right? So for a couple of days.
Every few minutes. Yeah. Maybe a day or two.
It's totally at random. So for 3 days, you don't hear anything. And then suddenly in the middle of the night, you hear like, ha, 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 ha.
Oh, my God.
Fuck, I'd shit myself.
Yeah, that's next level, like petty, right? For me, I've always thought like I've always thought if I ever was to get heartbroken, I'd do that kind of thing. Like I'd steal like the tin opener, the back of her earrings. You know what I mean? That kind of stuff that'll be inconvenient at the moment where you need it. But this guy's taking it to a whole nother level. Jeez, like, yo.
Yeah, it's big.
Yo, that's wow.
It's a little bit worse than sewing. It's a little bit worse than sewing salmon into the curtain hems.
And it's long lasting too. It's not going to, apparently these batteries can last for months and months and months, and you just won't even know. I mean, it's just so twisted. Again, move
that's
on.
The word.
You know, like you were saying, if you're going to move to another country, then stop talking about your old relationship. If you're going to, break up with someone, break up with them. Don't be so petty and nasty and bitter that you try and ruin their life with a noisemaker. I didn't even know these things existed until now.
Jeez, like, it's actually making me anxious, that type of pettiness.
What
like,
would be...
Wow, this guy really thought about
that. What would be the worst sound to come out of that? Farts.
Definitely children laughing. And maybe like a little melody that plays when you open up a jewelry box. Ding, 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 ding.
Oh, that would be creepy.
Like cricket. What about the, you know, a cricket sound? But like a cricket on your window.
Have you ever tried to find oh, God, that drives me crazy. It's like cricket's a good one. But I think it would be funny if it was farts. You know, you just you're lying in bed at night, or you switch off the TV, and you leave your TV room, and then suddenly in the corner of the TV room there's like you're like, oh shit. And if you don't know, like what I would do is buy them, and then I'd put them in the spare bedroom at my house and just see what happens.
I would actually, if they came in fart noises, I would buy that pack of 20, get someone to hide them in my house just for my own pleasure.
You just start
and
laughing,
laugh all day. Yeah.
But in that case, like, you know, especially because it was at levels where only she could hear it or he could hear it, or sometimes or they could, is, you know, you'd start accusing your partner of farting now. And you know how that could be. Like that would be.
I wonder if you'd actually, so because you know how the mind works, right? You might even. If you hear farts the whole time, you might even start smelling them, even though they don't exist.
Smelling, yeah.
Yeah. Because you know how our senses try to complete the picture for us? So you suddenly start smelling farts, even though they weren't there.
Or as Michael calls them, fartergeists.
Oh, man. So if you want to get hold of us, or you have an interesting idea for the show, you've got something that you want to tell us about, some feedback about how irritating we are, whatever it is that you want to tell us, contact at cliffcentral.com. We love all the feedback, whether it's good or bad or ugly. And I know I sometimes react badly to these things, but it's still fun. And you can rile me up very easily if you send me an email like that. But also, if you've got suggestions around people that you want on the show or subjects that you'd like covered, you can let us know too. contact@cliffcentral.com.
Something I want to tell you that happened when I arrived here. So there's a hotshot paddler here. I'm not going to tell you his name because he might get famous one day. Mm-hmm. So he's like big time, like five-star athlete. And I was sitting with him. He looks like if you imagine what you think Julio Iglesias would have looked like at 21, you know, like heartthrob,
fantastic,
that skin, the hair, perfect, and whatever, athlete. And as I landed and we were having supper the first night here, is he was talking about how he's breaking up with this chick on Monday. And he's 21, so he's just been like, yeah, no, I'm over her, I've moved on in life, you know, whatever. Like, he's 21, like whatever. But what I loved is that he's already decided that, and he's telling everyone, Brie, on Monday, I'm breaking up with her. Like, it's over. Yeah, I'm just over her. He's just, like, announcing it to everybody at the dinner table. And we started throwing in some suggestions. I said he should, like, break up with her via email, just to see what his responses would be, you know? Yeah. It's electric to see how the mind of a 21-year-old works. And I think to myself, oh, jeez, was I like that? Because he's like, I'm over. Yeah, guys, what do you guys think? Oh, I'm breaking up with her on Monday. I'm over anyway. Plus, I've already got another chick, he says. I said, oh, get him.
Well, this is a good discussion to get into, and maybe we've got a little bit of time before we're joined by Allison. But a friend of mine and his girlfriend, who's also a friend of mine, broke up or had an argument the other day. And now it's changed the whole energy because,
oh dear.
Yeah, where we would have maybe been seeing each other this weekend, now you have to tread carefully. Like, she's not talking to him or he's not talking to her, and there's stuff. And I don't want to choose between the two of them because I like them both. They're both entertaining and interesting people. Known them both for a while. So it becomes an admin issue. Now you have to second guess yourself every communication you send, because I have a feeling they'll end up back together again. But in the meantime, you got to tread very carefully, if you know what I mean. It's like two nations are at war, and you don't want to choose which nation you're on the side of, because if they start bombing each other, suddenly you'll find yourself in the firing line.
I have strong thoughts, but I'd like to hear what Leanne's got to say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very difficult. Now is not the time to say to the one partner, oh, I just never liked him anyway or her anyway.
Terrible idea.
Because there is a big chance they'll get back together.
Terrible.
Yeah.
What do you say?
So, who did you know first? Did you meet her through him or him through her?
Her through him.
Then, I mean, for me, that simplifies it as in, so in my mind, I'm just telling you how my mind works. She's got to go. But Leanne's nailed it. I once made this mistake, right? I once helped out a mate of mine. Oh, I'm breaking up with her, Brie, like, yes, I'm over her or whatever. And he listens to the show. So he will give us maybe feedback. Is that I said to him, Brie, I've never really liked that chick anywhere. Like, whatever, you know. And I was on his side. It's the boys. Does he not pitch up with her at the bride the Saturday? Talking about, he's telling me this on Wednesday at my house, crying about how he pitches up with her. Here's the best part to exactly what Leanne's wisdom just now. Now, after we were friends for since I was five, so let's call it like 20 years, maybe more, 26 years or something like that, lots of years, beyond two decades.
Right.
Now, because obviously he went and told her, it's why I don't trust people in relationships. And I have a rule. I'm never friends with my mate's girlfriends. I refuse to see your girlfriend without you or your wife without you. I'll never be friends again because of this incident. Now, we no longer, this guy, we cease to be friends because she told him after he told her what I said about her. Then it ended a relationship of like 25 years. And I know he listens to this show, so.
Oh, man. That's not good.
Yeah, never again. I will never comment like that. And my rule always, whoever I've known the longest, the other person's got to go, which is why I told you earlier, I like rules.
But
I'm not going to get emotional about it.
You shouldn't have to choose. You shouldn't have to choose.
But that's life.
No,
life is you have to choose.
No,
it's
not
life, you have to choose.
It's not true. If your parents get divorced, that doesn't mean you have to hate one of them and love the other one. Bullshit.
No, but that's an extent. No, come on. We have to exercise some existentialism there. That's a whole different thing. I'm saying, because friends, you choose. Family, you don't choose. That's why you don't get to choose mom and dad. With friends, you've chosen to have friends. So you do choose.
But
and you can choose. And you have to choose, actually. If you try and make both happy, Gareth, what happens? You know you're going to go to the
Bulelo.
What did he say about
no,
me?
No, no, no.
What did she say about
it me? It is also a choice to not get involved in other people's internecine battles. You know, I don't have to enmesh myself in your relationship. I can take a back seat and go, all right, well, you guys figure it out. I'm not choosing either of you. I'm not going to give either of you an advantage. And don't come and moan to me about each other. And when you've figured your shit out, then we'll see, because I'm quite prepared to be friends with both of you.
But are you going to have a hard and fast rule to say when I'm with you, you're not allowed to talk about her?
You can't have hard and fast rules with relationships. This is why you're miserable and single.
No, but I'm saying, so I'm saying what happens when she wants to say what a bastard he is? Because you know it's going to happen.
Then you stop her in her tracks and go, listen, please remember that I am not involved in your relationship and I don't wish to be. So stop talking like that now. That's for him to hear. That's not for me to hear.
Sounds nice in theory, Gareth. I look forward to seeing how this unpacks for you.
All right.
I'm really looking forward to this idyllic world you've created.
Mm-hmm. So when I got divorced, my best friend and his best friend were married. Mm. They were a couple. So that was interesting times, because she was consoling me through the hard times. Oof. In the meantime, having him for dinner, you know, at the house. So that was really a very interesting dynamic. Do we have time for me to give you an update on the Gabby Petito case?
I'd like to go to Alison Bentley. We'll talk about that a little bit later on. Alison Bentley is someone who's been seeing patients with sleep problems, both adults and children, on and off for the last 30 years. She is not only someone who has seen through 20 masters, 3 PhD students on various topics. She was also the person who ran the first diagnostic sleep laboratory in South Africa. That was all the way from 1990 to 1998. She's the founding chairperson of the Sleep Society. Alison, we laughed about the Sleep Society. We hope that no one nods off in the Sleep Society meetings. And we also, I'm reliably informed that you are, among other things, a real genius in the medical world. People have a huge estimation of you. They said that you're a professor of physiology too, and a medical research expert. It's a great pleasure to have you on the show this morning. Thanks for making time to be with us. Alison, can you hear us? I don't know that she can hear us. Simpiwe, while we're busy sorting that out, won't you just speak to Alison and see if she can hear us properly? I'm going to get her on as quickly as possible. Got lots to talk to her about. And sleep is a big deal. I mean, think about how many hours of your life you spend sleeping. If you don't do it properly, look, Bulelo's. Let's do a game drive with Bulelo quickly.
We were amongst nature here. I don't know if you can see.
I thought you went on over here. I thought you'd gone for a pee, because suddenly the camera picked up and we.
No.
No?
But you see where my finger is there?
What is it?
Monkey.
It's a monkey.
Oh, cute.
Yeah, living his best life, eating a banana.
That he's stolen from the humans.
That's it. Mm. That's it, the shitheads.
All right. While we're trying to get Alison on, I'm going to ask Simpiwe to just sort that out quickly for us. So, Leanne, just give us an update, because someone said in the comments that the Petito case is... Here we go. It's Amelia. She says, thank you for getting me hooked in the Petito case. How come this guy has not been caught yet?
That's dirty laundry. Mm. Brian Laundry, still on the run.
Oh.
And it's now got into the spot where the bounty hunter, who's very well known in America, Dog the bounty hunter. Mm-hmm. He's that guy with really long gray hair and he wears like leather jackets and studs and things. He looks very weathered. Mm-hmm. He's actually on the case as well now, and throwing out clues which are putting people off track and that sort of thing. Still searching for him. His parents have actually come out now and said, okay, we're going to join the search. We're going to help find him. Last night I dreamt, speaking of sleep and perhaps meshing the two stories together, I dreamt that Brian Laundry was caught. And if you look at the photographs of him now, he's this very clean cut guy with short hair and skinny. And when I was in my mind watching him being caught by the police, he was bloated and had this bright red hair and enormous beard.
Good God.
It's just so bizarre.
What a strange
But yeah, no, they're still looking for him. He's still on the run, and he's probably the most hated person in America right now. So we'll see what happens.
I'll tell you what, Brian Laundry may look a bit creepy and odd, but Dog the Bounty Hunter looks even worse. All right, let's try again.
Oh, no, he's crazy.
Let's see if we can get Alison on here. Dr. Alison Bentley, can you hear us? No. Still struggling here. I don't know what's going on.
Yes.
Oh, there we are. I can hear
anything,
you.
Hang on.
Oh, I know.
Oh, now she's on the phone to see. Dr. Bentley, can you hear us?
Yes. Hopefully you can hear me now.
Oh, good. How are you?
Yes, I can. And hopefully you can hear me as well.
Yes. Excellent.
I'm good, thanks. I'm very well. And yourself?
Excellent. So we've been talking endlessly about sleep over the last couple of years on this show because it's something that it seems people are suddenly interested in. We spend, you know, just about half our lives sleeping, and yet we don't take it very seriously. It's something you've taken seriously for years, something you've helped other people to research. So tell us quickly about your kind of experience as a whole over so many years of studying sleep, paying attention to the positive effects of sleep. Tell us why it matters and why this is an area of study that we should all be paying attention to and how it affects us all.
Okay, sure. I mean, I can't tell you that I went into sleep and sleep medicine because of some, you know, big drive to do sleep. I got into it accidentally, really, because I was trying to avoid something else.
Yeah.
And but once I got into sleep and started reading about it, it's endlessly fascinating. And you know, there's just so many things that keep getting added on. So, I mean, 30 years later, we're doing a lot more different than we were doing originally in the kind of early 90s. I mean, when we started doing sleep recordings, we were doing them on paper and pen. And we'd end up, you know, with a kilometer and a half of paper at the end of the night. With endless pens getting stuck and ink all over the place and a complete mess. Purely because at that time, there wasn't enough movable space on a computer to store an entire sleep study.
Wow.
And so then we moved, we could then, so you could do it on a computer, do it on a laptop, but then you need another laptop the next night.
Wow.
So, and then, you know, we had stiffy drives and then we've gone to optical discs and then we've gradually gone up. And now we're in a situation where you can store a sleep study on a little itty bitty USB drive. So it's very strange to have kind of gone that whole process, but also to have engaged with. A thing about sleep is it's something that everybody does. So it's not like lead poisoning that you kind of go, I have no way of interacting with that. I can't identify with that. Everybody sleeps.
Right.
And it is also something that I never tell anybody that I do. Okay. I just don't. So in any kind of situation, they say, what do you do? Depends. I often go, I'm a lecturer in postgraduate neurophysiology, okay, because I've had that life too. So I can't do that because it's pretty much a conversation stopper. Because if I say that I do sleep medicine, oh, well, here's my theory, here's my dreams, my whatever. You do dream analysis. But I think the big thing that's moved in 30 years is that when we started diagnosing sleep apnea and insomnia in the 1990s, it was like, oh, okay, fascinating. So what? And we did have conversations within that sleep society. It was like, we've got to find a way this kills you. Otherwise, no one's going to take it seriously. And so fortunately or unfortunately, we now know that sleep apnea, if it's untreated and severe, is going to kill you. So that's, I don't know whether that's good news or not, but it's good news for sleep.
It certainly makes it urgent. And I think for many people, unless something is urgent, as you rightly point out, they just don't pay any attention to it. Now, Leanne, who's on the show with us this morning, she has sleep apnea and she has one of those devices. We call it her sleeping Jesus, and she connects herself up to it every night. And otherwise, she'd be dead.
Yeah.
So changed
everything for me.
So what do we know about the sleep apnea, and can you perhaps help us to understand it from a medical point of view, precisely what's going on? And there are probably many people in the whole world, many people are listening to us this morning, who don't even know that they suffer from this.
Well, they wouldn't unless they have a spouse who complains about it at night. But you wouldn't know about it because basically, for most sleep disorders, you go to sleep, wake up the next morning, and certainly for sleep apnea, the key thing is you wake up in the morning and you feel trashed, feel as though you've been run over by a bus, and you don't get that refreshment that you normally feel from sleep. Unfortunately, what a lot of people do is put that down to work stress, I don't know, burnout, just lifestyle kind of things. They kind of go, I'm tired in the morning and I'm tired during the day. So they put it down to something else, whereas it is often sleep apnea or another sleep disorder, because there are other disorders that also kind of create that. But what's happening is it's essentially, so when I get down to my kind of kitchen physiology, it's kind of a sense that you have a hose pipe, which is the throat, which is the tube at the back of your throat here, but past your nose and past the back of your tongue. You have this tube. And so it's like having a hose pipe that you switch on. And so that water is moving through that thing. And then suddenly somebody stands on the hose. Hmm. And so they obstruct the hose. That's why it's called obstructive sleep apnea. And then they lift their foot off the hose and the air moves. And then they put their foot down and so on. And that obstruction occurs because of the physics and anatomy of that area. And that is, you have that area is designed to close, but only when you swallow. But now it's closing when you breathe. And so you only have one tube for breathing and swallowing, which is a bit of a design fault there. and so one tube, and it's designed to close. So the palate is designed to close at the back when you swallow, so food doesn't go up your nose. So that's designed to swallow. The tongue and the jaw is designed to go back when you start swallowing. So all of those, it's an area that can move. And so what it's not supposed to do is move when you breathe. So that's the key thing. And so obstructive sleep apnea then is when this happens when you're trying to breathe at night when you're asleep. Always starts with snoring. Yeah. So snoring is kind of the entry drug to sleep apnea, as I call it.
Mm-hmm.
It's the entry drug to sleep apnea. So there's very rare that you would get somebody with sleep apnea who's never snored. That's just not how it works. And snoring is a partial obstruction. And then the sleep apnea is a total or near total. Certainly enough obstruction to wake the brain. Because the brain, when that thing obstructs, the brain is in a situation where it kind of goes, you got to wake up or die. Like, that's your option. And so it will wake up every single time, which is a great thing in the middle of the night. But it's a problem in the next morning when you've woken up, depending on how bad your sleep apnea is, but 200 or 300 times a night.
So why?
Then you suffer those consequences.
Go ahead, Leanne.
Yeah, for me, it was, I think it's every 60 seconds or every 30 seconds that it was happening for me. And then, interestingly enough, there's so many chronic diseases associated with it as well. And that for me was where sleep studies and people who study sleep finally gained the credibility that they deserved all along. Was now cardiologists and pulmonologists were getting on board as well and saying, okay, I'm seeing a pattern here. It's all connected.
Yes. So that's the cardiovascular effects. I mean, we have really good data that says things like, if you have atrial fibrillation, which is quite a common disorder where the heart is kind of not beating properly, there's a little kind of flutter in it. So atrial fibrillation, if you have atrial fibrillation, one of the ways of fixing that is a cardiac ablation. So basically kind of go and zap your heart a little bit in a good way. So what we know is that if you have that ablation and you don't have sleep apnea, then the chances of that, of the atrial fibrillation coming back is about 30%. But if you have untreated sleep apnea, the chance of that atrial fibrillation coming back is like 70%. So it's doubled. So we know that if you have sleep apnea, we also know that, you know, if you look at the numbers, just the numbers of people who have sleep apnea. So there was an article in the Lancet that did a big modeling study on predicting how many people in each country would have sleep apnea. And in South Africa, it's moderate to severe apnea is over 20%. So one-fifth of the adults in this country are likely to have sleep apnea. Now, we know that it increases your risk of hypertension, of atrial fibrillation, of any kind of arrhythmia, of stroke, of all of those kind of things. And despite COVID, cardiovascular disease is still the number one killer. I mean, it's still the number one reason why people die. And so we've got this kind of little secret thing that's going on at night called sleep apnea, which people don't know is happening. But is actually, and it's interesting because what happens in sleep apnea, it goes through exactly the same mechanisms as cardiovascular disease and diabetes, in fact. So if you take type 2 diabetes, about half of them have sleep apnea.
Wow.
And then what the sleep apnea does is change the way that the fat cell works. So it doesn't work normally. And so if you are obese and you're trying to lose weight, but you have sleep apnea, you're kind of fighting a losing battle because you don't even know what the battle is because the battle's changed. So it's really it's a very systematic disease and actually affects a whole lot of things.
So Dr. Bentley, I mean I'm very aware of how little time we have to cover such a broad range of subject matter. but how much sleep do you think we need? I hear all kinds of numbers being thrown out by people. Churchill famously used to say 7 hours of sleep is enough for a woman, 6 for a man, and 8 for a fool. So how many hours are we meant to have?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because, you know, every patient who comes to see me and I say, how much sleep do you need? They'll go 7 to 8 hours. And I go, where'd you get that from? And they go, Google. So certainly every book will say you need to get 7 to 8 hours. But there's a bit of confusion about that because they kind of go, that's normal. It's not normal, it's the average. Okay, so if you take 10,000 people, the average will be 7 to 8 hours. I see a lot of people who are genetically programmed to get less than that, so 4 hours, 5 hours of sleep, and are battling to get that 7 to 8 hours. And once they realize they don't have to get 7 to 8 hours, they don't have insomnia anymore because they're actually getting the right amount of sleep. They mainly suffer from boredom, like, what do I do with all this extra time? I kind of go, I'm not your entertainment specialist. I'm not sitting here telling you what to do. Okay. But so that kind of thing. I mean, I have a patient who sleeps 2 hours a night and every night, and that's all she ever sleeps. And she only has ever slept that amount. The key thing about how much sleep do you need is it's the minimum you can get away with and still have good daytime function.
Okay.
So when people say, oh, you treat sleep disorders, I kind of go, no, I treat daytime function, okay, because that's the key thing, is to improve daytime function. So I don't care how many hours you sleep, as long as you are awake during the day.
Does it matter if your sleep is broken up? In other words, if you have a nap in the afternoon, or you sleep for 2 hours, then you wake up and you go back to sleep again, or is it important that it's a single block of sleep?
Now, that's a tricky question, because I think it is important that we have a solid block. But, you know, in the 1500s, we used to have two solid blocks. So English literature would tell us that basically when you came home from the fields, for example, you would wash, you would have tea. So that sandwich and tea, and then you'd go to bed because you were tired. But then you'd wake up in the middle of the night, have an extended period awake during the night when everyone would get together. It was a communal thing. And then you'd go back to sleep for your second piece. So certainly sleep is kind of cut into core sleep, which is the first 3 or 4 hours, and then the rest of sleep. There is a 24-hour requirement for sleep. If you have 2 hours nap during the day, that's going to come off your nighttime sleep. Usually it comes off there. But if you have I think there's a point where you can fragment into 2 or 3 pieces. But once you fragment more than that, it stops being restorative. So, for example, we know that patients in ICU, for example, have terrible sleep. If you look at their sleep, they have the same amount total sleep per day that other people would have. The problem is they have it all day. So they're having a nap here and a nap there during the day. 50% of their sleep is during the day and 50% is at night. So I think there's a line where too many interruptions start to impact the sleep.
I mean, this is the thing I'm very curious about. Then I'm going to hand over to Mbulelo and Leanne, because sometimes I ask the questions that no one's interested in. But in this case, I'm really curious about what sleep does. What is the purpose of it for our brain? Is it just a time for the brain to file things, to store memories, to figure things out? Or is it a time for everything to reset, to settle into a state of kind of calm and to be able to exit the conscious world for long enough for you to be able to sort out any physiological problems?
Yeah. So I think there was the sense very much that sleep was an opt-out. It was kind of like you just opted out and you rested. But actually what we know now is that everything is extremely active when you're asleep, and there is a purpose. There's a lot of stuff going on when you're asleep, and we certainly don't know it all. But some of the things that happen, for example, is as an adult, all the growth hormone that you produce during the day is produced in the first hour of sleep. And from that runs down the somatomedons and statins and all of that kind of thing, which doesn't necessarily cause us to grow right now, but causes us to repair. So there's a physical repair that happens at night. In the brain, so certainly in REM sleep, the dreams are about fire. Well, there is a big consolidation of memory that happens during sleep, not only during REM sleep. So the thing about sleep, the thing about memories is you input during the day, and at night you consolidate, and so that the next day you can recall. And if you interfere with sleep, you interfere with memories. And so people often have a problem with keep holding on to memories or hardwiring memories. So memory is definitely a thing there. During REM sleep, what happens is we have a special lymphatic system in the brain called the glymphatic system. And during REM sleep, literally the brain gets flushed. So there's a flushing of liquid that goes between the cells. And what it does is take out all the rubbish. Remember that brain cells cannot regenerate. So they cannot regenerate. They cannot make new ones. That's all you got. And so if you don't clear the rubbish out, then it's going to accumulate. And so it's one of the theories of Alzheimer's and the other dementias is that there's not enough of this clearing out that happens during REM sleep. So somehow REM sleep is compromised. Mm. There's not enough flushing out. So things start to accumulate. And the one that we know about is the accumulation of protein in Alzheimer's, for example. Wow. So there's a lot of that flushing out during REM sleep is incredibly important to keep the brain, you know, like if you didn't have pick it up at your house. I mean, think about it, pick it up never arrived at your house, what your house would look like. That's exactly the same thing that happens in the brain at night. So it's really important.
Bulelo, I know you're brimming over with questions. You go ahead.
Dr. Bentley, an absolute honor to meet you. I mean, your work's incredible. What I wanted to ask you was, I'm obsessed with sort of high level, high performance, and it's been something for me trying to sort of get my circadian rhythm right over the last sort of 3 or 4 years after seeing a sleep expert. I just wanted to kind of get your take on whether determining when we sleep, when we achieve REM and all of those cycles, whether we can actually know when we'll be most productive in the day from any evidence through knowing when, and I recently got introduced about 2 years ago to something called your temperature minimum, which if the evidence I've read, it tells you actually when you're going to be most productive between 4 and 6 hours later, I believe is the window. Perhaps I'm wrong, but I'd just like to know if you're interested in performance, how important is it to sort of regulate your circadian rhythm? And is it possible to reset your circadian rhythm so that you are sleeping better to perform better is basically where I am in my life. And I'd like to know your thoughts.
Okay. So usually whether you're a lark or an owl is kind of preset. And so you will always have a natural tendency. A lot of people are in the middle. So kind of, if we look at sleep time, 10, going to bed at 10, waking up at 6. I'm an owl, so I can stay up till 1 o'clock in the morning, sleep till 8 easily. Other people are larks. They're usually farmers. And so they go to sleep at 9 or 8:30, and then they get up at 4:30, happily get up at 4:30. I've never experienced that in my life. So I cannot happily get up before 7. And so that is kind of set, okay? So you have that. And depending on whether you're a lark or an owl, you will have, and that's driven by melatonin and driven by your body temperature. So your body temperature goes down at about the time that you feel the sleepiest, that it's the easiest for you to fall asleep. That's your body temperature, driven by melatonin, which is produced about 1.5 hours before that. So that's how the system works. So there is a preset kind of tendency, right? So if you're an owl, there's no question the best time for you to work is in the evening. So I went through med school, the whole way through med school, and people saying, you must get up at 4 and study because that's the best time to study. And I would wake up at 4 and I'd wake up at 4:05 and 4:10 and 4:15 and it just didn't work. But I can study till 2 o'clock in the morning. And they would go, no, you can't do that. It's the wrong thing. And I was going, but it's right for me. Do you know what I'm saying? So everybody has their own kind of thing that works for them. If you're a lark, then you are most productive in the morning. And so that morning slot is the most productive for you. So my daughter's a lark. By the time I get up on a Saturday, she has been to the gym for 1 hour, made a smoothie, had a shower, and she's ready to go. And I'm like just waking up. But then she's super productive. But then come the evening, she's like 9 o'clock, I'm out, I'm in bed. Okay. And I'm kind of going, but I've just started working. I've just hauled out the laptop and I'm starting to work then. So there is that kind of natural tendency. Can you change it? Yes, you can with melatonin. You will find that you kind of have to keep on taking melatonin, you have to keep on changing your natural circadian rhythm. Because the minute you stop taking it, you're going to go back to your kind of genetic tendency. So you can't really change that. Does that make sense?
No, very interesting.
And you guys all have missed circadian rhythms, by the way. Yeah. Every kind of radio person on the planet has missed circadian rhythms because you work stupid hours and insist, go to your body and go sleep here. And sometimes your body goes, oh, hello.
Yeah, I mean, I've just got used to how it feels to be up early, even though I'm like you, I'm an owl. I mean, I used to work late into the night. Now I realize I start feeling guilty somewhere around midnight because I'm not asleep yet. And I go, oh, well, I've only got to calculate. I've got 6 hours, blah, blah, blah. And as you say, that's almost a self-imposed insomnia. It's ridiculous. Dr. Bentley, it's such a pleasure to have you on, and I'm so grateful for your time this morning. I'd love to talk to you again at some point. It's fascinating stuff, and we've only just scratched the surface this morning, but I'd love to have you back at some point and discuss some more of this.
You're welcome.
People love it. The comments are just rolling in from people who want to ask you all kinds of things. Obviously, we can find out more from the work that you've done. I didn't even know there was a Sleep Society of South Africa. I feel embarrassed about that, but we joked that you guys all get together with your sleeping bags and your sleep societies that you just fall asleep. Obviously,
I know. We don't call it a sleep society anymore. So now it's called the South African Society for Sleep and Health.
Very, very good. Well, thank you for being with us this morning. I'm going to say goodbye to you, and maybe we can all just figure it out a little bit more carefully how we can get the maximum amount of sleep and the maximum amount of good out of sleep.
It's important to get.
Hugely. Thank you so much. Alison Bentley joining us this morning, and she's absolutely the foremost expert in this subject matter. I mean, we could have carried on talking to her for hours and hours.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Good questions all around, and I'm sorry we didn't get to answering all of them. I did try to throw a few of them in. We'll see if we can get her back at some point. But right now, it is time for Borge. Here he is, George Meany. Hey, George.
Hi, Borge.
What's happening?
Morning. How's it, Rianne?
What's going on, George?
That was very fascinating discussion, Gareth. I mean, I was listening intently because I, like Mbolelo, I try and be the most productive you can, and sleep is one of the big things that that make you productive.
Yes.
And she was echoing that exact sentiment. So it's very interesting that there are different kinds of people that need different kinds of sleep at different kinds of times. So you got to, I suppose, figure it out for yourself.
Well, I mean, I didn't even know that there were larks and owls. I just expected that people should all have the same kind of pattern, but that some of us just prefer mornings and some of us just prefer nights. Turns out that there are two distinct classes of people when it comes to that stuff. So, George, what's on your agenda for this morning?
So different classes of people or different kinds of people. We just released the EV buyer survey. Autotrader just released the EV buyer survey. If you go to reports.autotrader.co.za, you can go download the latest EV buyer survey. Mm-hmm. So we did the same thing last year. We surveyed almost 3,000 people, asked a bunch of questions to try and get the sentiment for appetite for electric vehicles in the country. And last year gave us what I would assume or say is a baseline. Okay. We then did an update to that EV buyer survey at the beginning of this year. We did a very small sample set, but now in the last couple of weeks, we've done a new full-on EV buyer survey. Mm-hmm. And it turns out, Gareth, that nothing much has changed. Now, you might think to yourself, well, it's the same people filling in the forms, etc. That is absolutely categorically untrue. We got 2,800 respondents. And if you think about visitors to Autotrader's website, this year's visitors are going to be very different to last year's visitors in the main, because people don't change cars every year. Okay, so that means that this particular survey is a very different set of consumers versus last year's survey. But the results are almost identical, which gives me comfort that you can read into this electric vehicle buyer survey and get some value out of it. And the stark reality is that the three things in the market still exist when it comes to mass consumer adoption. The most important thing is people want a car under 500,000 rand. And that came through in the last survey last year as well, and in the interim survey at the beginning of this year. The second thing is they want faster charging times, mm-hmm. and there's still an element of range anxiety. The faster charging times and the range anxiety, the range anxiety and the want for faster charging times have come down slightly by a couple of percent, and okay. that I think is because we're all preaching the message EVs and educating consumers around EVs. And I'm living with an EV, so I'm trying to kind of tell the truth of the matter, and there's some challenges. But it's very encouraging to see that the results are very similar to last year.
Okay. All right. Well, I mean, listen, we know electric vehicles are a big thing, but there seems also to be a bit of a propaganda swing going on here. Like there's a huge amount of money and marketing that's being thrown at EVs. And I'm just wondering if petrol heads, the people who like the original combustion engines, whether those people aren't getting a bit annoyed by all of the EV propaganda.
They probably are, but I don't think they're going to win in the end of the day. It's going to take a long time. So you're going to be your petrol head and you're going to be able to drive your noisy car for the next 10, 15 years.
Yeah.
But I think this is a reality, Gareth, and that's, whether it be propaganda or not, at the end of the day, the consumer is going to choose.
All right.
And, however long that takes, it takes that long. So, but, it's encouraging to see that the results are the same. And I think we've got a way to go as a country. We need to actually get our A into G very quickly.
Okay. All right. What else is happening? We'll go and check out that report, but what else can you tell us?
So Rolls-Royce, you would think that Rolls-Royce has a very older, more affluent demographic.
Sure.
And it turns out that Rolls-Royce has just put out a study that shows that Rolls-Royce has the youngest age demographic across the entire BMW, Mini, and Rolls-Royce family. The average age of a Rolls-Royce buyer is actually 43 years old.
And that's young compared to Mini and BMW.
Yes.
So who are these 43-year-olds and how do I marry their sisters?
Right.
Don't know, Mbolelo, but they do come out of China and the United States mostly. So sure. You're in the wrong country.
Jesus, that's amazing. They're the youngest. Who would have guessed? Just shows you how this research works. It's incredible. All right.
It's unbelievable. But and then a police in California stopped a Tesla driver. Well, he wasn't driving. The car was on autopilot and he was drunk out of his mind. This car was driving on its own and the police realized what was happening. And they actually stopped the car by, trying to slow it down, driving in front of it, boxing it in, and they eventually stopped the car. And this guy was drunk out of his mind, and the car was driving him somewhere. They still don't know where the car was going.
But
that is crazy.
This is going to be happening more and more as we get these self-driving cars and drunk people get into the passenger seat or whatever, and they say, "Oh, drive me home." It's going to happen. And how do police respond to that? Because the driver may be relying on the car and the car may be able to more or less do a good job. Certainly it depends on human factors as well. But who do we arrest? And if we arrest the driver but they're not driving and the car's doing most of the work, do we take Tesla to court?
Well, I think in any situation, the person that made the decision to push the button self-driving is the person responsible. That's what I would think.
Okay.
You decided to push the button self-drive and or autonomous driving and you knew you were drunk. You knew you couldn't drive the car or you went to sleep. So I think it's still the driver's responsibility. But in this instance, it's raised two questions by the police. The one is, how do we get the OEMs to have a hotline of some sort where we can tell them, please switch off this car, please make it park? So Tesla can effectively go and push a button somewhere, and that car safely turns off and goes to the side of the road and stands still. So that's been the one question that's been raised by the authorities, and the other question is safety, as you point out, Gareth, is happens in the end when somebody gets hurt?
Somewhere a choice has to be made. If we're going to make the driver who presses the button responsible, then we can't have Tesla interfering and pressing their own button, because that can lead to all kinds of trouble too. What if you've got a perfectly sober and sensible individual, but Tesla, for some reason, through data that they're getting from their car, decides that someone is driving irresponsibly, and they press a button and suddenly your car won't do what you want it to do, pulls over to the side of the road, and you've done nothing wrong.
Yeah, exactly. So, I think those are all valid arguments, and it's things that the world needs to grapple with.
Okay.
On a dumber note, there is a bridge in Cape Town.
There's a bridge.
There is a bridge in Duisenberg in Cape Town, mm-hmm. that is aptly called Bridget. Okay, and this bridge apparently is only 2.5 meters in height.
Yeah,
and has about one truck crashing into it every month.
Wow,
that is crazy. I actually lived there for a while, and I can't picture where that is.
If you're driving, I think towards Cape Town. So if you're driving towards the harbour, because I know where, I mean, I've obviously looked at where this bridge is based on the story today. But it's a metal bridge. If you Google Bridget and the Musenberg famous truck eating bridge, you'll see this bridge. It's a metal bridge, and apparently people don't learn that the sign of 2.5 meters high means the bridge is 2.5 meters high and it ain't going anywhere.
Jeez. Or are we not thinking after the 28th crash, we could maybe just lift the bridge to 3.2 meters? George, what are we up to here as a country?
Yeah, correct.
So authorities, well, people have said, well, why don't you dig under the bridge and make the road lower? But apparently the bridge is at sea level. So doing that would mean that if it heavy rains, it would dam floods, up. That kind of thing, it would dam up, and that would be a problem. So Bridget is standing, and people keep crashing into the bloody thing.
I see it now, and when you see it in writing, it's actually hilarious. Bridget, the truck eating bridge, with trucks stuck underneath.
I love that it's got a name. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
All right. Well, there we go. Some personality.
Very finally, Gareth, this is a freaky story. Three Anne's going to love this story. There was a teenager in Egypt whose number plate predicted the date and time of his death.
Ooh. Ooh.
So his number plate was CIA-9-25-9. And he died on the 25th of September at 9 o'clock.
Oh my God!
Sure.
Well, coincidence. You know, even a wrong clock is right twice a day.
That's true.
So I don't know.
And apparently, there is. If you go and Google it, there is a scientific calculator that if you're of a certain age and older, this calculator online can go and predict your death.
So, oh no! Please don't give us the URL. I'll get obsessed. I'll be googling and entering birth dates and checking on people I know, checking on myself, making updates the whole time. It's not a good idea. This is a terrible idea. Do not go to this website, please. George, don't give anybody a URL.
I won't.
All right, everybody. That's all we got time for this morning. Thank you very much. And we will see you on Monday. Have a good weekend. And behave yourself. Don't do anything stupid. Bulela will see you back in studio on Monday. CliffCentral.com